God's Daughter by Brenda Gild. Larry had company in his office, a guest, an old lady occupying one of the two chairs facing his desk. She'd brought a light scent of freshness, of meadow mixed with laundry dried outdoors. A halo of white hair framed her deeply wrinkled, tawny skin and sharp, slate-colored eyes. Her navy coat and shift bore no jewelry, her arms no watch, not even a purse, an ungilded lily down to her navy hose and shoes. She had been a great beauty, and was still, to those who appreciate the work of 97 years. From her coat pocket, she took a small manila envelope. From it, she extracted a color snapshot, which she handed to Larry. A toddler stared at him from the photograph, as if he should care. With cool eyes, he scanned her dark hair, rosy caramel skin, and dancing brown eyes flecked with blue-green gold. With a strong voice, despite its tremolo of age, the old woman said, "This girl can show her face, hair, and beauty to the world." What was her accent? Barely noticeable, a mix of long ago and far away? This grown-up girl cannot. She handed Larry a photo of a woman shrouded in black wraps with only her eyes visible. They were similar in shape and color to the baby's. What difference is their need for freedom, for a woman's right to choose for herself? Larry's eyes flicked from photo to photo. Mother and daughter, he wondered idly, are the same girl grown up. Then he handed them back. "Miss Larry," he said, his voice warm, one of his best features, "I would love to send a reporter, an entire news team, to make a headline story of the unveiled women you will be joining in protest, but..." He sighed deeply, hoping to find the just right words. She nodded her head gently, as if agreeing, while giving him a quick once-over in assessment. Before her sat a balding man in good trim for his 52 years, comfortable in sage-colored slacks and sweater of complementary hues. She saw evidence yet of the keen, freckle-faced boy he'd been, but she guessed that something was off. His deep-set blue eyes sat in dusky circles of resident fatigue. He sat behind a desk piled with a maelstrom of notes, reports, books, newspapers, videos, audio tapes, CDs, and more, in contrast to a well-organized, tasteful office. He was struggling with more than forbearance of her importuning, more than overwork at this time of tumultuous news, more each day. He breathed in, again catching her subtle scent, fresh as a child. He couldn't tell her the truth, the directive he'd gotten to ignore all but the dominant, most pressing issues in the Middle East. He chafed at this, not the logic of the edict, but being told it all, damn new meddling boss. Obviously, if something explosive happened regarding women's rights and women wrong, he'd give it priority. But this didn't sound like anything crucial in the bigger picture, however sympathetic he felt toward this compelling woman. Larry continued, "I'm sorry, I can't do it. I absolutely agree that women under repressive governments must win the right to dress as they please. It's an important first step to achieving other, more vital rights. I applaud this initiative, when larger changes may provide a context for smaller ones, and vice versa." She leaned forward to see if his weary eyes and vaguely sallow skin were a trick of lighting. He guessed she was going to press her case again. He quickly said, "I personally would like to be there, to be in the thick of women daring to protest, with heads proudly bared, to be routed and punished for it. But that's not my lot in life. I'm stuck in this chair, and believe me, we're stretched. Oh boy, are we stretched, covering the big, big stories. Recognizing, of course, that women achieving their full rights is a big, big cause." There, she thought, he said it himself, a throwaway word of more importance than perhaps he even knew. Stuck. She glanced at the light boxes overhead. She considered the dull February sky beyond the rain-streaked view from his 21st-story perch, of neighboring office towers. It wasn't a trick of lighting. He was off track. His health, his work, perhaps more. He continued, "That a woman of your age is involved in taking such risks at this time, at any time, is wonderful and inspiring. But while our resources are slim on the ground, anywhere near the proposed protest location, I'm very glad you alerted us, however. We have freelancers there who'll send reports if things turn, let's hope not, to a newsworthy item in the global stream." He glanced at his watch. 8 minutes. With luck, he'd have her out in the 10, he'd promised her. He rose to skirt his desk and see her out. Ouch! He flinched slightly from a dull pain in his left leg. He continued, I'm very sorry to disappoint you. On a personal note, I'm delighted. No more than that, I'm honored to have met you. Our dear May tells me that you've been friends for 90 years. Amazing. How lucky. She stayed seated, looking up at him, standing tall beside her. She smiled and nodded, more as if sizing him up than accepting his rejection. Mr. Singer, she said, I've come to talk with you. And I'm grateful. It's been a pleasure, and I'll keep an ear to the rail about your undertaking. She didn't budge. Her eyes didn't move from his. No, I've come to talk with you about the news, the big news. He sat down on the chair beside her, partly because standing had reacquainted him with his deep tiredness, and partly because somehow she commanded it. What did she have? The power of a mother times 10? She continued. About what you're trying to do. He smiled. Get back to work, I'm sorry to say. My time is ridiculously tight. I know, that's why I wonder about this. She circled her hand to indicate his spacious, bright office. A bank of 6 televisions, their screens now blank, hung from the ceiling over the entry door opposite his desk. A large, tidy workstation rounded one corner with 2 monitors and a laptop atop it. Books sat straight and ordered on shelves. Every cabinet's doors and drawers were neatly shut. Discreet, impressionist paintings filled spare wall space. She pointed to the rat's nest desk compared to this. He laughed. Yeah, it's a mess. This isn't the news falling in on me. It's just that we're making big changes, major restructuring, redefining how we deliver the news, integrating a lot of new, well, everything. I know, she interjected firmly, stopping him short. From the same manila envelope that held her photograph, she took a plain sheet of paper folded in half. This might interest you. He took her paper reluctantly and started to open it. No, read it later, please. What matters now is what's missing. Carefully, word by word, she said, it's in the peripherals. It's in the context that defines the core. That's your strength. The center isn't holding. Oh boy, you're so right, he thought. She leaned forward and said conspiratorially, Rosebud. Goosebumps ran up his arms. How did she know? He hadn't told anyone in decades that the classic old movie Citizen Kane by Orson Welles had propelled him into the news business and still fueled his dream of writing the great book that every journalist thinks he's got in him. With a surprised smile, he said, exactly. I worked with Orson, she said, standing to go. She moved slowly but fluidly. He was attentive. You serious? I mean the man himself? Larry rose to his feet with her. He contained a grunt as he again felt the pressure in his left leg. Her eyes swept him from thigh to feet. There, she said, pointing to his left shin. Asymmetries can be serious. Your coloring is off, too. Are you getting help? Larry blinked hard and blanched a bit, that she saw so much. Well, he was working to reveal little. Who was she, other than old Cousin May's friend? No, he mumbled. She reached into her coat pocket and, with an elegant twist of her wrist, opened her palm to proffer a small, unbleached cotton sachet on a thin, necklace-long thong. This might get you started in the right direction. As he took her gift, she said, herbs from Mount Olympus. They're a tonic, not a cure. And a piece of Mount Parnassus at Delphi, where I was born. He felt a pea-sized rock inside, then sniffed the sachet. Ah, that scent, that lovely scent. Thank you, he said warmly. It smells, healthy. She flashed a smile, a split-second unforgettable zap. Then you know what to do. I do? He blurted like a boy, his heart and mind racing. He really was sick, and it was making him far too emotional. Yes. She bowed slightly with body and eyes, a delicate Eastern gesture. The 10 minutes you kindly found for me are up. Bless you, Larry Singer. She turned for the door. No, wait. I said 10 minutes, but I'm curious about you and May. She shrugged apologetically. I'm sorry. She fixed her eyes on his and measured her words to make sure he got every one. Like you, she said emphatically, her eyes fast on his. I have very little time. Larry's breathing tightened. Had she guessed that, old as she was, she might outlive him? He'd told no one but his partner about his diagnosis, certainly not May, and then only in roundabout terms, unable to say cancer aloud. It was just a little lump under his shin, self-contained. It wasn't the deadly gut-bone-brain kind. And that his lymph nodes were acting up was just his immune system fighting it. He was determined to make it disappear by strength of mind and healthy habits, no medical meddling or heroics. Such cases existed, and there was every reason he could be one of them. Maya stood framed by the doorway now. He stood rooted, watching her go, as if the clock had stopped. He would remember her exit, a moment frozen in time. She held up a soft fist, as if still clutching the sachet, or was she gesturing solidarity for her cause? "Thank you," he said, meaning it fully. With the grace of a Tai Chi master, she circled her hand open to reveal her open palm. He felt like her blessing had slipped off her hand to his heart. With a trace of a smile, like an ancient imp, she vanished behind the closing slit of the door. Larry stared at the blank door, thinking, "God help me, I'm desperate for angels." He looped the sachet around his neck, then tried to imitate her fist-to-twisting wrist motion, the exquisiteness of her simple gesture. He smiled. It wasn't easy. He tried repeatedly with one hand, then the other, while watching from his window to the street far below. His office oversaw the Baltimore Inner Harbor, with an impressive view of its single World Trade Center tower, rising 30 stories high, and the USS Constellation, the U.S. Navy's last all-sail ship, anchored beyond it. He might see Maya leaving the building, or he might not. So small were the swarms of tiny cars and tinier people from such height. No matter, he needed to think, and the view calmed him. His high perch had thrilled him years before when he first moved into the news director's office in the Media 8 Tower, headquarters of the ever-expanding conglomerate fondly and otherwise known as the Octopus. Its eight giant tentacles employed news outlets, radio, TV, film, video, digital everything, and many apps to deliver every form of information and entertainment available and in development. After 6 years, he'd worked too many long days with his back to the real world, and his mind on every place else to appreciate, literally, his vantage point. This was the first time he'd given it more than a glance in many months. Within minutes, Maya Solari emerged onto the plaza, her white head uncovered in the rain, her old legs taking her slowly to a waiting dark gray sedan, an EV Fiat, Larry guessed, not many in the city. "Gone," he thought. "Just one of millions down there, and I feel unbelievably, what? Like I've got to see her again, to see more of what she sees in me, as if, how foolish. It might save me from, dear God, dying. Me? Larry Singer, robust and forward-looking, staring at death." The car pulled away and merged with the endless wheeled stream. "Go safely, Maya. Godspeed," he said quietly. He returned to his desk and the demand stacked high on it. "Of course I know what to do," he thought, hearing Maya's voice saying that he did, while looking at the shambles of his work and health. He snorted and muttered, "I don't have a freaking clue." Larry sat down heavily and took a weary whiff of his new sachet. Her words echoed in his head. "What's missing?" "In the peripherals. Rosebud." From his top desk drawer he took a lined notebook, the kind he'd used since junior high school. On the cover, he'd scrawled Telling News Number 72, the name of the tell-all novel he was going to publish about his years in the news game. He flipped through his notes to a new page. "Maya Solari, February 06, he wrote atop it. Then what? She'd knocked the words right out of him. He was totally compromised. He'd have made a headliner of her women's daring little protest in an instant, if he had any real say, and she'd just made that crystal clear. He told her to get lost, essentially, because his new boss was keener on invitations to the White House than noting any real changes in the proper order of the universe. Women me-tooing and revealing all over the place wasn't his favorite topic by a long shot. But then, if reporting on a tiny protest against forced veiling led to a newsworthy crackdown on the women, who was sure to suffer the blunt end of that stick? Children, women, the old, the frail? One step forward could lead to two bloody steps back. Who was he to stir up news about women shouting bald-faced and bald-headed about hijabs and niqabs? If even the tiniest report leaked out of the dictatorship being defied, he could send Fran Roma, his ace and favorite reporter, to follow up. For now, he had to process why Maya had disturbed him so much. He hadn't felt so touched by a single encounter since, what? The Dalai Lama, Nelson Mandela, Mother Teresa? No, she outdid them. So clearly did she penetrate his core, as if she could read his fate and as if she cared. She tried to use him to get a story, fair enough, but then she dropped it, as if reading him was what mattered. He shook his head and buried it in his hand. He just wasn't used to that. He closed his notebook. He didn't need to write a word to describe her, so etched in his mind was every moment they'd shared. He couldn't grasp the thoughts and feelings she'd roused in him, let alone put them in neat rows of nouns and verbs on a clean page. The phone rang, jarring him back to the war zone of his desk. To his assistant, he said, "Thanks, Nora. Yeah, tell him I'll be back in 10. Hold my calls until then." Larry opened the piece of paper Maya had given him. In small, tidy handwriting, he read, 1. News in Systemic Context, Gaia Incorporated. 2. Subscribers as sole shareholders. 3. Closed-loop production plus delivery. He skipped over the words, his eyes unfocused. It was all brilliant, and all too much. He tucked the paper in his notebook and stashed them in his desk drawer. He put his head down on a small stack of reports on his desk and succumbed to giant waves of overpowering sleep. Too soon, the phone jangled him awake, then rang every few minutes after. Between incoming calls, he made more. He checked his emails, texts, messages, various social media, and sent quick replies. He sifted through his paper midden. At the top of each hour, he tracked 6 different news reports on his television screens. He made notes, dictated letters, and called in reporters, assistants, and associates. Hours passed. His big view window became a mirror as the sky turned from gray to black. Larry's old cousin May made her way carefully from kitchen through dining room to living room. Her beige mop of a dog waggled about her black rubber boots, which held spindly legs in rose-colored tights. She followed a winding path through stacks of files, binders, and boxes covering the worn oak floor of her worn old house. She carried a saucer and cup of steaming tea rattling in her shaking hand. Her wizened fingers ended in rose-painted nails, matching a circle of rhodonite beads about her scrawny neck, hidden in part in the folds of her purple cowl-neck sweater. A skinny black sheath skirt matched her boots, an unbrushed black wig sitting awry on her head, leaving wisps of white hair flying from blue-veined temples. A delicate old ear held a small hearing aid. Maya, in her navy shoes and hose, followed May and Mutt. They navigated past folders bearing names writ large in black felt marker in an old schoolmarm's hand. Mater Matua, Isis, Ashtar, Persephone, Telea, Caradwyn, Hall, hundreds of goddesses and mythical women from around the world. More such high-rises of paper rose from the dining table and chairs, obviously long unused for meals. May's paper industry burdened the living room as well, except for the scruffy old chair she took and a narrow spot on the sofa, which Maya claimed. The dog flopped contentedly at May's feet. "Good lad, Byron," she said, through once lush lips that had collapsed to a wrinkled portal over ill-fitting dentures. She had been lovely in her youth, with broad cheekbones and quick eyes, as the small black-and-white studio photo atop the nearby upright piano showed. She had signed it in her generous hand, "Best love, May." Next to it sat a larger color shot of Larry, with microphone in hand, broadcasting live from a city in mayhem behind him. May said to Maya, "Thank goodness Larry said no. But what if he'd said yes? How would you have talked him out of it?" Maya shrugged. "I'd have digressed to, oh, I don't know, something handy. What we need in a moment of decision should be under our noses if we're paying attention." "Hmm," May said, taking a sip of tea. "Like the photographs of Luna and Pavla right under Larry's nose. Did he ask anything about them?" "Of course not. Dear fellow, he'll kick himself one day. He tends to get distracted by the obvious, the nature of his business and all." "He's not well," Maya said. "Really?" May's eyes widened. "His blood's off. He's fighting something. It could be serious. We didn't have time to discuss it. Oh, it seemed he wanted to. For this and other reasons, he'll see me again." May smiled. "Good. That means he'll be around soon to pump me for information about you. I'll mete it out carefully, keeping him keen but not overwhelmed. I'll pump him in turn about his health. In the meantime, I gave him an idea that might help him if he pursues it." "Wonderful. Anything I can help with or encourage?" "No, not really. He needs to see the sense of it and consider the logistics. And I need to talk to you about something else. You see, as I looked at the pile of papers in confusion on Larry's desk and sensed his confusion at this pivotal time, I realized that I must get on with what I'd been thinking about since, oh, Hiroshima, really. The mess on Larry's desk perfectly symbolizes the far greater, ever-growing, overreaching, uncontrollable mess everywhere. He needs a new paradigm by which to restructure his work and his world, as do countless others. I'm increasingly convinced that we have the requisite critical mass of people ready for the truth if we dare to tell them. She leaned forward and said, with quiet urgency, I've decided that it's time to tell the truth about me in a biography. May's eyes darkened with fear. No, she whispered, her head now trembling in her hands. Maya nodded calmly. Yes, we've never been more needed overtly, directly needed after millennia kept behind the scenes. The time is right to be brave and bold. Oh, Maya, at what price? Your line, Luna, you could be sentencing her to death. Babies die all the time, Maya said, are killed. I've decided, with thanks to Larry for inadvertently making it clear, that we must test our faith and take this chance. At this critical juncture in life on Earth, I believe that our best covert work is done, and we must surface or disappear. May struggled for breath. I understand, but I can't. She lost her voice to sobs. Maya continued, I'm not asking you to write it. Heavens no, you're doing more than enough, dear May, far more. You have contacts, however, who could work from our notes. I'd like you to narrow the list for me. Then, when I return, we can discuss it. I'll take it from there, unless you reconsider and want to be active in the writing. May took a deep, calming sip of tea and forced a smile. Her voice wavered. The singular Maya, identical to the rest, yet none like you. I will do all I can to forward the written, published celebration of your life. Thank you, Maya said. My foibles and failings, too. The complete Maya.
At 9 o'clock that evening, Maya headed for bed in the small room May kept for her at the back of the house. She shut the curtains to a moonlit view onto a large, high-fenced yard with fruit trees and overgrown remnants of May's former vegetable, herb, and Japanese garden. Songbirds and squirrels now reigned over the brambles. She would rise at 4 a.m. to begin her long flight to a tiny protest built on brave women's dreams and hopes. May played quietly on her upright piano, with Byron curled at her feet. Her dentures sat beside Larry's photo and the one of her former loveliness. As she warbled an antique tune, a rap sounded at her front door. Byron leapt up with a yap. She continued her bass arpeggio while rewarding him with a right-hand pat on the head. Good boy, you sing too. Her left hand repeated the bass run an octave higher. Byron shushed, his tail thumping the floor furiously, eyes expectantly on his lady love. Rat-tat-tat, a second summons. Byron stood up and growled. He snapped at a spider dropping from the ceiling past black lacquered shelves. They held dozens of brass ornaments blanketed with dust, threaded with spider webs. Candle holders dripped with thick layers of wet wax, dusty for years now, too. By the third knock, Byron yowled and pawed at her rubber boot. She stopped playing and cocked an ear. Must be the door, she said. What would I do without you? As she rose to reach for her dentures, Byron pulled at her skirt, knocking her off balance. She saved herself with a quick plunk back onto the bench. She put her teeth into her mouth while shuffling to the front door, with Byron bouncing around her wobbly legs. Larry, she said delightedly, opening the door wide to welcome him. May, my beautiful May, he replied, wrapping her in a big hug. I guessed you'd be by soon. Here, give me your coat. Larry shed his all-weather jacket and hung it on a nearby hook. May continued. Maya said it went well. She did? I turned her down. I know, don't worry. She understands and was pleased to have met you. I'm sorry, really sorry. I was hoping she'd be here. She is, dear, but she's gone to bed and I can't disturb her. She has a short night, then some very long days. She leaves before dawn. Oh, no, Larry groaned. I work too late. I couldn't get away sooner. Come in anyway, if my company will do. Would you like tea? No, thank you. It would be nice just to sit and talk a bit, if you have the time. May set Larry on her sofa in the spot Maya had taken. Byron danced at Larry's knees and nosed about for an ear scratch. May sat in her ragged old chair and looked intently at Larry. Maya's right. You look tired, not as pink as you should be. Larry winced. She didn't miss a thing, did she? I'm overworked, that's all. Have you seen a doctor? I have, and I'm eating my veggies, I promise. How about you? Veggies and vitamins, thank you. Now, Maya tells me that your desk is worse than this. May cackled and waved a hand over her paper maze. That's not like you. Far worse, not organized, like this chaos. The big boss has hired a nephew to haul us into some integrated media warp zone, and he's wreaking havoc. Nepotism, May said. Nephewism, literally, the bane of all ages, if you know your history. This Randy Bane is a top-down guy, all surface and trends and glitz, doesn't have a clue how things work from the inside out. Luckily, he's on salary without any production budget, ever, if I can help it. Maya's concerned that you're losing your drive or focus. She senses that something's... May looked worriedly at Larry. Byron looked equally worriedly at her. Wrong, she finished. Byron put his head on his paws, as if resigned to the verdict. Larry quickly shook his head. No, no, I just have to sort through the mess in the middle out to my tidy edges, just like Maya said. It's a nuts and bolts thing, plus a little psychological warfare with the boss's pet. He lightly rubbed up one arm to a tight shoulder muscle, which he squeezed to unknot. Maya said she'll see you soon when she's back this way. Larry brightened. Great. Give me some warning and I'll clear the deck for her, the desk, the dance floor. I'll meet her wherever and whenever she wants. Oh, no, Larry, we can't plan this. I never know when she's coming, and I can't contact her. I see her when I see her, and so will you. Really? I thought you were close friends. We are. But she comes to me. That's been our arrangement since we met, which is why we stay friends. He teased. What? She a fugitive on the lam? May chuckled and shook her head. She's many things, and nothing you'd ever guess. So, why the mystery? Who is this Maya woman? May thought for a moment, then asked, Do you remember when you and I first met? Larry nodded. 23 years ago at that horrible funeral. They're all horrible, with all due respect to your husband. Second husband. Mother dragged me. What a trial. I didn't understand her enthusiasm for funerals. In fact, I still don't, as she faced her own. I was miserable, imagining her dead in a few months, which she was. You were indeed miserable, as happy to meet this old cousin as a hornet at a rained-out picnic. Don't ask me why, but I thought you were worth getting to know. Larry laughed. I'm glad you persisted. Maya was there. Larry's eyebrows shot up. I was surprised that she knew Erwin had died. I hadn't told her, hadn't seen her for months. I was immensely grateful that she came. I introduced you to her. Oh, no, how awful. I don't remember. Pearls before swine. Two pearls. May chortled. She brought a small bouquet of fresh herbs. You know, I do remember that, Larry said, pulling out his sachet from under his sweater. I mean, the bouquet itself, not her. She gave this to me today. He sniffed it. Something about her was so familiar, so... What else? There was something else about that bouquet. A small black doll. Yes, that was so strange. I mean, the herbs to start with, not your usual bunch of glads and mums. Then the little Moses in the bulrushes. What was that all about? May smiled. We met on a ship from France to home, I in second class with my parents, after a purchasing trip for my mother's dressmaking business. We'd seen all the latest fashions in Paris. Maya in what we called steerage. I was 5, she was 7. Do you want to hear this story? Of course. We were on very separate decks, locked one from the other. But early in the voyage, we met during a lifeboat drill. She had a black doll in her arms, over which we made instant friends. When we parted, she gave me her beautiful baby with the idea that we might sneak through some door or other to meet again. Mama thought the doll was lovely, and Daddy was glad I'd made a new friend, from which deck he didn't know, unaware that, if we were to continue our friendship, some intrigues were required. They let me take the doll to dinner that evening, all fancied up in satin ribbons. A senior officer, not the captain, he kept to first class, shared our table, and the minute he saw my baby, he whisked her from my arms and out of the room. I tried to follow, ready to raise a great protest, but mother and father kept me pinned in my seat with very stern looks. We were the only Jews above steerage, that's another story, and they were afraid of any scene. No blacks on board, the officer whispered when he returned. May imitated his trollish hiss. When Daddy asked what he'd done with the doll, he indicated throwing it overboard, then he wiped his hands together. May made 2 swipes of her own hands, and that was that. My parents were horrified, but what could they do? I was too stunned to cry at first, and far too upset to eat. Mama took me to our cabin, promising repeatedly to replace the doll when we landed. I ate the rest of my meals there, And when I ventured on deck, my parents kept me from confronting that wicked officer, for I'd have kicked him in the shins or worse. I didn't see Maya again until we debarked. Mama and Daddy made me wait for her and explain what happened and apologize. Oh, how I apologized! And get an address to send her a new doll. She wouldn't give me an address, and her mother wouldn't take any money. We told them where we lived, this very house which Father was building for us then, and she promised to visit me when she could. Her mother gave me a sachet of herbs, the same as those. She pointed to Larry's tiny pouch of them. I don't know where Maya and her mother went from there, but they visited some months later, and she continues to drop by to this day. Larry blinked, taking a moment to sort his swirling thoughts, then asked, I understand the little black doll now, but why for the funeral? My first husband was my great love, as you know, and a great musician. I was his muse, he said, and his compositions were our offspring, our love forever. Oh, it sounds impossible after so many years, but tears filled her old eyes. I'll never get over him, she smiled softly. David, even his name is music. She pulled herself up and continued, My second husband was a great mistake. That he lied and cheated to win my affections, I could forgive, for at least that places some value on my heart. He thought I was rich, however, and after we entered holy wedlock, he gambled away my savings and modest inheritance, accepting this house. He feigned worldliness when a show was required, but he really was a horrid bigot, the sort who threw black dolls overboard. He had no love of culture or the arts. He had the ears of an insect, the taste of a toad. Larry winced. Why didn't you leave him, divorce him? I feared I'd have to forfeit the house, which I could not do. For Maya, to his credit, he behaved himself in front of my friends when sober and had the good sense to disappear when drunk. He was a sloppy sot, but never violent. At his funeral, Maya knew that I was free again, one of the only people there who understood that I was rejoicing, not grieving. My God, what a story! And I saw it all and missed everything, Larry snorted. Maybe I'm in the wrong business. May smiled. It's a little late, and you're a little too successful to say that. Times of re-examination are good, dear, as long as you have your health, and that means good habits, good attitude. Larry grinned disarmingly. I'm fine, May, don't worry. I'm a singer. Like your grandfather, now there was a singer, she chortled, and a rascal, too, from the day I met him. Tell me, Larry said quietly. Oh, I mustn't bore you with another ancient story. Bore away, please, Larry said, as happy as a boy with another bedtime tale. Well, if you insist. May paused. I was 4 years old the summer I met your grandfather. We had traveled for days, long hot days, to get to Uncle Jacob's farm. Big cousin Samuel, your grandfather, he was twice my age, we called him Sammy, took me straight into a field. There were cow pies everywhere, and I fussed about the smell. Sammy kicked off his shoes, stepped in one, and dared me to do the same. I quickly learned that cow pies squish wonderfully up between your toes, especially new warm ones. Larry laughed. Our dainty little May. Oh, yes, we hopped from paddy to paddy, looking for the biggest, steamiest ones, having a gay old time. Sammy led me to even better ones behind a fence, which he failed to mention was part of the bull's pen. Apparently, his father had been talking of selling the bull, and to Sammy, no bull in sight meant no bull anywhere. Suddenly, he must have come from behind a hayrick. Mr. Bull appeared, snorting mad at our fun and his business. He charged, and I scrambled to the fence. Some good that would have done. But your Grandpa Samuel, for reasons of bravado or madness, stood defiantly in a huge plop, and when the bull was unbearably close, he opened his mouth and started singing, Oh, solo mio, la, 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 as loudly as he could. Larry gasped. Oh, no. The poor bull lurched to a stop, his eyes wide until the whites were showing, and at the last second he snorted off the other way. Larry grinned. Phew. Now, Larry, I can't match Maya's insights and advice, but... May paused, looking at him intently. When the bull's charging and you're ankle deep in steaming bull pies, never forget you're a singer. Larry burst with laughter. May, you old wag, you are a treasure. He rose to kiss her on the forehead. Now, alas, I've got to go. Thank you so much. At the door, he said, and thank you especially for sending Maya my way. Rip Van Winkle may wake up yet. Good, you'll see her again soon, God willing. She has a daughter and a granddaughter you should meet, too. and a baby great-granddaughter, Luna. They're all remarkable. I bet, one at a time, though, if you don't mind. Good night and sweet dreams.
A Muslim woman stood at the Lufthansa check-in counter at JFK Airport in New York. She was covered from head to foot in a brown silk hijab and jalbab, or headscarf and baggy coat. By her sensible brown shoes sat an expensive canvas carry-on bag. The clerk asked sharply, "Are you checking that?" pointing to the bag. "Any other luggage?" The woman shook her head. With elegant hands, she deftly produced her ticket and passport. The third finger on each hand bore antique gold rings. A married woman, whatever the continent. The clerk expertly scanned the ticket. "Mrs. Khalil Ramahi, business class, flying to Frankfurt, leaving in 3 hours." The clerk flipped open the passport. She quickly scrutinized the photo and the hooded woman before her, a tawny-skinned, dark-haired beauty without embellishment. Her eyes matched those in Maya's snapshot. Her first name, Jala, the little book said. Age 38, although she looked a few birthdays short. The clerk narrowed her eyes and glanced again from face to hands, then closed the passport and returned it. Manicures, pedicures, all kinds of cures keep the wealthy polished and young. "Returning home?" the clerk asked as she waited for the computer to spit out a boarding pass. Mrs. Ramahi didn't reply. What could she say? That she was flying on from Frankfurt to a destination she dare not disclose, on her way to keep her grandmother from being flogged for supporting women who dared to protest their right to vote without having to show a note of consent from male guardians, which is legally required, or feeling compelled to wear a chador or burqa, which is not required, but necessary to keep from being identified by fundamentalists run rogue. It all went badly and was hushed up well, so best to get to Frankfurt and buy the next ticket there, where authorities weren't so twitchy about Arabs traveling to their former or present homelands. The old woman was doubtless handled roughly during arrest and when transferred to a woman's prison. She was likely too fragile to survive more than a few lashes. Did her punishers know the risks they were taking? Could any would-be rescuers, mere women particularly, thwart fundamentalist authority and law? How? By infiltration, bribes, diversion, and brute force to breach the prison? Or would it take a miracle? The clerk asked, "Would you like a window or aisle seat?" The woman, distracted by her concerns, didn't answer immediately. The clerk guessed she didn't speak English, hence pulled out an aircraft seating plan to point out the seats available. She raised her voice to ask again, "Window or aisle?" The woman quickly chose an aisle seat, one as close to the front of the plane as possible. The silver-haired man behind her saw and smiled faintly to himself. He stood back, giving her a bit more space than usual in such a queue. He wore a butter-soft leather jacket, Gucci's, and a Rolex, all tastefully understated. If his hair were dark, not white, over Mediterranean features, he'd appear to be in his late 30s, early 40s. He shone with admirable good health and fitness. By looks and lineage, he could doubtless be passionate, but his aura was detached and cool. He kept his honey-brown, fox-like eyes patiently focused on nothing. After Jala was processed and turned to leave, she brushed close to him. She noticed that his jacket zipped up with a small gold crucifix pull. Reverent or irreverent? An odd mix. He smelled slightly of musk. Their eyes met, but his didn't flicker with a moment's recognition or even curiosity. Good, she thought, or maybe too good. She would have to be cautious. But then, when was she not? In the pre-flight lounge, she easily tracked his silver-bright head above the Arab Weekly she was reading. She went to a washroom and watched how he reacted. He did nothing that had any bearing on her movements, not even a look or a split-second catching of eyes. Upon boarding, he took a window seat in her row. The seat between them stayed empty. After he stashed his jacket and leather shoulder bag in the overhead bin, he offered, in mime, to stash her bag, too. She shook her head, dropping her eyes. She tucked her bag under the seat in front of her. With coat on and scarf shrouding her face, she buckled into her seat. During takeoff, he slipped on reading glasses and flipped through Italian onboard magazines. When they were at cruising altitude, he removed his glasses, tuned his headphones to the in-flight classical music channel, and napped. She hid behind a romance novel in Cyrillic, the paperback cover too love-struck and lightweight to invite conversation.
She soon grew tired and nodded off. Mealtime came and went. The woman and her seatmate ate silently. Both declined to watch the movie. He got up to use the lavatory only once, motioning his desire to slip past her and saying nothing as she made way for him going and returning. After many hours, a deep male voice cut through their separate reveries. "This is Captain De Ruyter," he announced in German. "We will be landing at the Frankfurt Airport Terminal in about 40 minutes. We are a little ahead of schedule." He gave the weather, time, etc. The seatbelt sign lit up and bonged. Jala ignored it and made quickly for the nearest vacant lavatory, while a steward repeated the captain's message in English and French. In the cubicle, she pulled a tiny satellite phone from a pocket within the folds of her clothing. She punched a button. In American-accented English, she said into it, "Mother, we're landing at Frankfurt in 40 minutes. The man seated next to me has been close by from when I checked in. Italian, I think. He hasn't given me any reason to be suspicious. He hasn't said a word to me at all, not even to excuse himself to step past me, but I don't know, probably paranoid. Hard not to be in this situation. I think I'd better bail at Frankfurt." She listened and smiled. "Yes, I hear her. Mum, mum, mum. Tell Luna mum, mum loves her." A loud announcement insisted that all passengers return to their seats immediately. "I've got to go. If you can't get anything lined up, don't worry. I'll stick to this plan and make it work. I'm probably overreacting. I'll call you the second everything's clear." When she returned from the lavatory, her seatmate wore his jacket again and had his luggage in the seat between them. He flashed her an intimate look and slight smile, then smoothly averted his eyes back to his magazine. Her heart rate quickened as she settled, clicked on her seatbelt, and also feigned interest in her reading. Soon, February drizzle and the dull gray of Frankfurt Airport buildings whizzed by the aircraft window. She said to the man by the window, "Nice weather for ducks." He chuckled. "Ah, you speak English," he said in Italian-accented English with a British twist. "Rather well." She smiled. "I try." She quickly hit again in her novel. The plane docked at the Frankfurt terminal, and a catwalk clunked onto the plane. The instant the steward opened the aircraft door, the silver-haired man slipped what felt like a fingertip to Jala's ribs through the unprotected side of her bulletproof vest. "Cyanide," he said, "disguised as an allergy shot." He rose, forcing her to rise with him and step into the aisle, holding her near. He whispered to her, "I will use it, believe me, if you say a word or try anything." A nearby attendant caught Pavla's drawn face and asked with concern, "Oh, dear, are you—" "She is fine," the silver-haired man said authoritatively. "A little unsteady on her feet, that is all. She has asked me to help her. I'm with security. Please, no fuss." Arm in arm, luggage over shoulders, they exited slowly along the walkway to the terminal. The woman leaned into him and slowed her pace, playing up her apparent illness. "Good," he said. "An ambulance is waiting and an armed escort. There is no escape." As passengers hurried past them, he said softly, "You're a beautiful woman, Pavla Blanka. I was prepared for this, but so close. Your charisma is most—" "Spare me. What, my flattery? Or the certainty that, if you make the least move to escape, I will kill you? I would rather not, you know. My superiors want you eliminated, but I have got them half convinced that you are worth more alive than dead. Half convinced. The other half is up to you. I'm Dr. Dino Trigliani." She glanced at him with surprise. He continued, "Yes, you know my work. I have positioned myself both to forward our shared interest and to buy you time, a lifetime, if we are careful." They were the last passengers to reach the wide view of the terminal lounge. Those ahead rushed to pick up their luggage or make connecting flights. Three airport security guards stood together watching the crowd disappear. One of them, a large, goonish man, said something urgent to his two co-workers and pointed toward the baggage claim area. They hurried to investigate. Only the two stragglers and the aircraft's crew remained to clear the area. A flight attendant caught up to them and asked if she might get a wheelchair or call for a shuttle. Trigliani smiled assuringly and waved her away. She returned to the plane. In the nearest boarding lounge, a young man in overalls squeegeed the windows of an emergency exit door. He flashed his pinky finger as he worked. The remaining guards strode toward Trigliani and his clinging woman, smiling smugly. Beneath his cap, his brush cut had three shaved stripes angling up from each ear. When he was 10 paces away, she goose-headed her fingers to make a close, lightning-fast strike to Trigliani's groin. As he buckled, she kneaded the poison from his hand, then struck a pressure point in his neck to send him crumbling to the floor. The security goon rushed in. She charged him, to his surprise, then ducked down to scissor his legs with her hand, toppling him backward, his arm, then his head, cracked on the floor. He tried to get up, then rolled back with a sick moan from the pain of a broken arm and possible concussion. She ran to the janitor, and he led her quickly through the exit door, down a flight of stairs, and out to a waiting airport service car on the tarmac. She dove into the back seat with her savior, and the car sped from the terminal. She said, "Benedici voi." The driver said, "Bless Alma, we have a private jet lined up, one of Khalil's friends. It's always available for you." She said, "Wonderful. It's such a gamble. Public airlines offer anonymity and heightened security for operatives as well." They drove in silence until they pulled up to a small waiting jet, its engines roaring. She said, "Thank you, most profoundly, thank you." She rushed from the car up the stairs into the jet. Within half a minute, the sleek aircraft taxied toward the runway to await clearance for takeoff. She was soon safely in the air as the sole passenger in a luxury quasi-living room with a discreet attendant. Pavla slipped into the small, well-appointed lavatory and again used her phone. "Mother, it worked perfectly. I'm on one of Prince Hamid's jets." "Thank you. I'll arrive a few hours ahead of plans. Time I can definitely use. I was right to be suspicious. The white-haired man is Dr. Dino Trigliani." She spelled his last name. "His research is tangential to mine. He was counting on me cooperating because of it. Had I recognized him, of course, I'd have bailed when I first saw him. Very clever attempt, a cyanide injection, if I didn't play along. At a lucky moment, I disarmed and dropped him, got his assistant too, and Mother, I don't think anyone saw. It's amazing. They have some explaining to do, which is perfect. They'll cover for themselves, and they'll have to do that for me, too, or they'll be digging themselves in deeper. Khalil will smooth things over from his end, so I expect I'm off scot-free, thanks to the help you so quickly lined up for me." She listened for a moment, then said, "Everything you can get on him, yes. He wants me alive for research purposes, which makes him less risky than others intent only on our destruction. No, don't worry. I'm fine. Not a scratch. Yes, I will. Kuda Hafez."
Under a black, starless sky, Prince Hamid's jet circled the twinkling desert jewel of Jeddah, an opulent old new city looking west over the Red Sea. Pavla's plane pulled up to the stunning new airport terminal with sweeping lines and no expense spared. She cleared customs as Mrs. Khalil Ramahi, proffering a note from her husband permitting her to travel unescorted. A wealthy gentleman greeted her as his wife, Jala. He took her to a luxury sedan waiting outside the nearby entryway. They slipped into the back seat with a darkened privacy shield between them and the chauffeur, who whisked them into the night. In Arabic, Khalil said, "You're too late. I'm sorry. They advanced the punishment. They flogged her this morning." Pavla groaned. "Oh, no. Is she alive?" "Yes. She's in the prison hospital." Pavla closed her eyes in pain. "How many lashes?" "The full dozen, but we're more concerned about her face and neck." "What?" "Of course, how could you know? She was attacked outside the polling station by a madman, a zealot. He used a blade of some sort to slash her from forehead to here." He drew his finger from eyebrow to the base of his neck. "I'm sorry, it's a long cut. She lost a lot of blood. It happened behind the scenes, nothing recorded or reported. The police watched and waited. When several women were bleeding, they made arrests using clubs and fists." Pavla winced, fighting tears. "So barbaric. Sometimes it seems so hopeless." "Only insiders know, of course. The international press has been told lies and more lies." Pavla nodded. "I've checked some sources and heard bits and pieces, but only knew that whatever happened was caught and shut down before it got bloody. Where are the others?" "Several are in prison with Maya. We don't know how many, being tortured, some raped, I'm sure, and promised death if they don't renounce their evil ways and do penance for life. Their families are under great pressure to straighten them out." Pavla sank back in the seat and moaned. "So much pain, so little gained." "Your grandmother would disagree, I think. Jala saw her this afternoon when making charity rounds. She told her that you're coming. Don't worry, no one overheard. and your grandmother rallied instantly, despite worrying about the dangers you face. With the worst behind me, Pavla said, or so I hope, that my luck will hold as it did in Frankfurt, with great thanks to Hamid, you, and others. Luck, my eye, Khalil said. I pity anyone who tries to strong-arm you. Well, there was a little damage to a fellow, the way he tripped and all. How difficult will it be to get Maya out of prison? Jala has already arranged to bring her to our house. Really? I'm amazed. They don't want an ancient old lady dying there, and Jala swore 1,000 painful deaths that no one would know what happened in the street or in the prison. Her work at the prison demands that anyway, so she just renewed her vows. Khalil sighed. My dear wife, always bringing trouble home and making it vanish. The hospital, the prison, they love her. As do we all. She's an angel. He chuckled. A contrary one. Jala will fetch your grandmother tomorrow if she's well enough. Hamid's jet will come in handy again, secreting the two of you out of here. Thank goodness. I am most grateful to all of you, Pavla said. For long seconds, they watched the lights of Jeddah blur by through the car's darkened windows. Finally, he said, your grandmother hasn't given up. When Jala left her, her eyes were bright. She believes that some important seeds have been sown. Pavla touched his arm. Thank you, Khalil. On that, I'll say my prayers and try to sleep tonight. The night will be long, much longer for her. Morning. A hazy sky softened Jeddah's hard edges of low coral stone buildings and soaring modern spires, the tallest reaching a kilometer into the sky. The city's 1,300 mosques rang with the muezzin's sunrise call to prayer over the city's 4 million people, mostly Sunni adherents, a few Shia, plus foreign workers. An unmarked white van buzzed from the impressive new Toban Central Prison, a few kilometers north of Jeddah, and dodged through rush hour traffic to a large, solid metal gate in a tall brick wall surrounding a modest mansion. Each of the home's high walls had a heavy bolted door and no windows. Prying eyes from any quarter atop the fence could not see the light and greenery of the spacious courtyard within this exemplary estate where women played out their hidden lives. Satellites and drones, of course, could spy down, but controls and sanctions limited their invasions of privacy. The driver snugged the van up close to a side entrance, and the real Jala Ramahi emerged from its back doors. She matched Pavla in size, with all other differences covered by a black chador. Two female attendants, swathed in black also, carefully lifted and carried a gurney bearing Maya Solari's blanketed body. She rested on her side to spare the lash wounds on her back. A teenage girl opened the house door for them, keeping discreetly behind it lest any peeping Tom see her in tight jeans, bright t-shirt, and copper-streaked hair. Jala thanked her daughter as they hastened inside. She led the attendants to a guest room brightened with a spray of fresh flowers, reflecting double their cheeriness in the dressing mirror behind them. Jala and attendants transferred the old woman to the bed, setting her back gently against a lambskin throw over many soft pillows. They spread a light afghan over her faded blue hospital gown and remarkably fit old arms. Her hair, still dirty from dried blood and inadequate sponging, matted about her face. She had been sliced from above the left eyebrow to chin, then caught again on the neck, luckily missing the windpipe and jugular. The jagged, raw gash had been treated with a yellow-brown snake of iodine, her left eye puffed with deep purple bruising. When she was fully settled, Pavla appeared, wearing a plain brown abaya and shoulder-length hair flowing free. She gently kissed Maya on her uninjured cheek, lingering to savor the old woman's warmth and sweet scent, underlying the smells of prison and crude care. Pavla pulled the chair close and took a soft old hand. Maya drew strength from this, closing her eyes to feel it fully. Pavla studied her face and said quietly, "It's not stitched or even bandaged." Maya rasped, her breathing labored. "It's better this way. Air to heal it. I also thought they might lighten the lashes." "Did they?" Maya shook her head. "No matter." She shut her eyes. After several shallow breaths, she opened them and said, "Outside the polling station, I wasn't quick enough. Intervention came too late. It's a sign, Pavla." She paused. "I must go home." A shiver ran up Pavla's back. "To Delphi," she whispered. Maya nodded slightly. Pavla's eyes filled with tears. She said quickly, "I'll take you." "No, you must go back to Luna and to safety as soon as you can. You could take me as far as Athens, then your mother." Maya struggled for breath. Pavla whispered, "Yes, we'll arrange everything." "Thank you, dear. Now I have to tell you. Listen carefully." She paused. "I want my story told, published. I've asked May." "What?" Pavla gasped. Maya summoned her strength to say firmly, "It's time. You know all the reasons, the state of the world. We must have courage, faith." Pavla caressed the wrinkled skin and blue veins on Maya's hand. She calmed her swirling thoughts and racing pulse. Finally, she said, "I can write it during my sabbatical year. I can start next month." Maya shook her head. "No. Your own work, Luna, they're too important. I've begun arrangements. Your mother knows. It will take a year or two. Not too much more, I hope." Pavla sighed deeply and said, "We might even be safer this way." Maya nodded, whispering, "Yes, but you and your mother will judge that after I'm gone. To publish is my wish, but the choice will be yours." Pavla nodded, then quietly said, "You know we will." After long seconds of studying her granddaughter with deep appreciation, Maya reached up to run her fingers slowly down Pavla's cheek. "You are so beautiful." Pavla replied softly, "As are you, my mirror to come. And Luna, your was, our to be. I have a new photo of her." From a pocket in her dress, Pavla pulled a snapshot of an 8-month-old girl, the same beautiful child Maya had shown Larry. She sat amid ferns growing from limestone rocks of an old quarry. "From Pipestone, last week," Pavla said. Maya smiled. She took the photo, held it to her worn breast, and surrendered to fevered sleep. May sat at the dining table, her bird-bone frame tiny among the ever-growing stacks of files. She worked without her wig, her hair a ragged, self-trimmed mist of white strands too thin to hold a bobby pin. She wore a worn chenille house coat and old slippers that used to be white and matching, now just drab and worn, but clean. Byron lay at her feet, his tail thumping occasionally. 3 scholarly books sat open in front of her, one propped on the other. Her teeth and hearing aid sat beside them. Pink-nailed fingertips pushed black felt pen in bold loops on foolscap, then switched to red pen to underline key phrases. She tucked her notes into a file folder marked Tiamat. Her old rotary dial telephone rang loudly, startling Byron to his feet in full yap. May said, "I hear it too. Good boy, you sit." He plunked his wiggling bottom down and watched May fiddle her dentures into her mouth by the 3rd ring. She picked up her hearing aid, which squealed horribly in her hands. Byron howled. She tried stuffing it into her ear anyway, but the squeal repelled her. "Darn thing," she cursed, shaking and twiddling it until it was quiet. By the 10th ring, she got her hearing aid in place and answered the phone with a sing-songy, "Hello? May, this is Alma Solari, Maya's daughter." "Yes, dear, how nice to hear from you." "And I, you. It's been too long. My news, alas, is not nice. May, mother is injured and dying." May swayed and held the tabletop for balance. "What happened?" "She was slashed at the poles in Jeddah, flogged in the Daban prison." "Oh, no," May moaned deeply. I clipped a tiny report that said some dissidents were questioned then released unharmed. That was old news from last year, recycled in case anyone caught wind of the latest and got curious. Just as well, though, that no one's prying, because she wants to return to Delphi. There's little time, and it will be dangerous, impossible, had there been any publicity. I'm on my way to meet Mother in Athens. We'll go from there. I know her wishes, dear. I can put Nikos on the next flight there if arriving tomorrow isn't too late. No, just in time. That would be wonderful. Can you spare him on such short notice? Of course. I have neighbors who check in on me, and he's due for a week or two off anyway. Thank you. When he arrives, have him go directly to the embassy district. Alma gave instructions, which May wrote down. Have you prepared him at all for this? No, I've told him nothing, and he never pries. That's why he's been my driver and helper for so long. He's met your mother and drives her occasionally. I'll fill him in as much as he needs to know. You'll find he's very trustworthy, very discreet. You'll be in good hands. Thank you, May. Sweet words at this time. If this all works out, if Mother makes it to the Omphalos and beyond, the results could be spectacular. Let's hope. I'll be watching the news, collecting every coincidence I can. She said coincidence is two words. Bless you. And you, dear. May's voice trailed off. Yes? Tell your mother for me. She searched painfully for words. Oh, you don't need to tell her anything. She knows. After May hung up the phone, she navigated unsteadily to her piano. Byron tagged close by. She sat down and held trembling pink talons over the keyboard to play, but brought only her index right finger down on middle C. Her head slumped. Oh, Maya. Nikos Platidou landed in Athens on a red-eye special direct from Baltimore International Airport. He set his watch to the time announced on the plane's PA system, 6 minutes to noon, February 10th. His eyes were large and long-lashed in a basset hound face. He was big-boned and loose-limbed, at home with his frame and 50 years. Like many Mediterranean men, he grew more handsome with age. He had shaved quickly in the airplane lavatory, missing a tiny patch or two. His dark gray slacks and light gray shirt had rumpled on the flight. He carried a gray all-weather jacket over his shoulder. Through customs and baggage pickup, he wiped cobwebs of jet lag from his face. He rented a mid-range car with tinted windows and drove from the congested airport to the more congested streets of Athens. The sun shone hazily through brown smog, but was still too bright for him, even with sunglasses. He squinted and blinked his way to the embassy district of central Athens, where he glided up to a whitewashed gatehouse and announced himself, Nikos from May, into a likely-looking box. The gate swung open without hired help or host in sight, and he pulled up to the huge, whitewashed, blue-trimmed, flower-decked home. At the front door, he was ushered in before he could knock. Nikos emerged mid-afternoon with Maya on his arm. Her white hair was bright again, and she wore a clean navy dress, hose, and shoes. Her wound had turned rusty red, the iodine to dirty yellow. The accompanying bruise had faded to light purplish green. With immense difficulty, she hobbled to his car. Maya folded stiff bones into the back seat, moaning involuntarily when her savage back hit the lambskin and pillows Nikos had prepared for her. She stretched out as best she could. Nikos put another lambskin on the floor beside her, then covered her with a light blanket. She said in Greek, "Thank you, dear. I'm fine." A woman of middle height and middle years got into the front passenger seat. She stayed covered in a black coat, headscarf, and sunglasses until they were running fast and safe on the highways beyond the big city. Just past the quarry where the Parthenon sprang from Athena-inspired brows, the woman removed her excess wraps and shades. Alma Solari's likeness to her mother was uncanny. Pavla was doubtless her girl. She had a symmetrical face, café au lait complexion, and dark hair half-salted white. Her great beauty was now fading, but notable still. She settled into a quiet journey towards sacred Parnassus, through sunset into dark night. In grainy blackness, they zipped past the ruins of sacred Delphi and its several hotels, which had few lights burning in the off-season. The town of Chryso, by comparison, sparkled on the hillside, seen in glimpses through black trees lining the snaking mountain road. Alma sunk from view, and Nikos entered Chrysos in darkness, apparently alone. Chrysos is a Greek town in the best way. It has whitewashed buildings that shine in the hot sun and glow in the moonlight. It has crooked, cobbled streets that wind up hillsides where even weeds grow picture-perfect. It is an everyday village filled with lively families going about their everyday business. It has squat widows dressed in black, crisscrossing the streets to shop, attend church, visit grandchildren, and have rumored affairs. It has tavernas filled with smoke and men whose best hours are spent producing the haze and playing tavli, or backgammon. Chryso is also a lucky, famous village, with Mount Parnassus just miles to the east. Parnassus, mountain of the gods, and the once greater goddesses, home of the Oracle of Delphi, guardian of the Omphalos, navel of the universe. Summer is crazy with tourists, all hands dedicated to serving their endless appetites. Winter gives the area back to the locals, the hardy few thousand who know that the true place is as much about the deity's gray moods and sometimes thundering storms as the easy gold of high sun days. Come February, the earth had begun to percolate again, but all was quiet yet. At Apollo's Taverna in Chryso, the owner, Spiro, a stout man of about 60 years with beautiful teeth and teasing eyes, stood behind the bar pouring glasses of ouzo. In front of it, a young waiter filled a small bowl with olives from the grove carpeting the Delphi Valley to serve with the drinks. A handful of local musicians tuned up on a small stage. A straggle of customers sat at this table and that. Spiro stayed open year-round, but made his living in the summer. Winter hours were almost a charity to keep the town alive, a place for family and friends to meet and gossip. He ran a cluttered establishment crowded with pots and pans, local pottery, braided garlic bundles, stuffed game birds, and liquor advertising. Local artists had brightened one wall with a mural of Apollo's Delphi. Good cooking, good music, and good dancing times permeated the place, giving it breath and life. Spiro crooked his index finger for the waiter to come close, then whispered, "I have a surprise tonight for your aunties. Nikos is coming." Cheekily, the young man replied, "So? He's not interested in our aunties." "Yes, he is. It's been 3 years. He's ready now." "No, he isn't. He wants a woman like his wife was, blonde and cool and American. Our aunties are dark and passionate," and he made plump curves with his hands, "big. Exactly what he needs. No hothouse flowers. A Chryso woman ripe for babies. He needs those too. You can tell all the ladies it's their lucky night, but don't say why. It's a secret. I have not told Elena yet." The waiter laughed, for telling Spiro's wife was as good as telling the town. "Do I give all the single ladies free drinks to prepare them for their white night? Good idea, as soon as he arrives. Lots of retsina, bouzouki. We will dance and sing until he drops, then marry him off while he sleeps." Nikos drove directly to a side street and onto a winding lane. He turned off the engine and glided into a small parking spot at the back of a large house, pulling close to a blue-painted doorway, his apartment, rented out to tourists much of the year. He opened his car door quietly and got out, as did Alma, who shadowed him. He unlocked his suite door, and they slipped in quickly. He saw no prying eyes in nearby windows, whether dark or lit through curtains and blinds. Inside the tiny Spartan kitchen, Nikos turned on a radio to hide their hushed voices. Roller blinds were closed tight and would stay that way. He returned to the car and covered Maya with the lambskin from the rear floor to disguise her as a stack of such merchandise. With great care, he picked her up, including the lambskin she rested on, and carried her to the double bed that filled the bedroom nook. She bore her pains without a sound. Alma settled her in. Nikos fetched their luggage, this time closing the trunk and doors without concern for spies. Sure enough, a curious face, then another, peeked through cracks in window coverings. He had to head to Spiro's taverna soon, before word reached Elena and she came to flush him out. "May I make tea?" Alma asked. In his tiny kitchen, Nikos half-filled the steel pot with water and set it on a hot plate to boil. He fetched two china cups and saucers out of a cupboard. Alma gave him a sachet of herbs for tea, the same as Maya had given Larry, minus the loop and thong. In hushed Greek, he said, "That smells good." "Herbs from Olympus. Mum used to gather them as a girl with her mother. Friends supply them now. Will you have some?" "No, thank you. Maybe tomorrow. I will return here by mid-morning, if that is okay. I have my cell phone. You may call at any time." "If you have to rush back here, how will you explain it?" "I have business, yes, and jet lag. Do not worry. I cover everything." Alma smiled warmly. "Thank you."